Blue Mars, Cassette 17. So a few days later, they walked up a gangway onto the deck of a long, narrow sailing ship whose single mast and sail were one curved unit of dull white material shaped like a bird's wing. This ship was a kind of passenger ferry, sailing eastward around the North Sea in perpetual circumnavigations. When everyone was on board, they motored out of Dumarthuray's little harbor and turned east, keeping within sight of land. The ship's mast sail proved to be flexible and mobile in many different directions. It shifted in its curves like a bird's wing, every moment different as its AI responded minutely to catch the fitful winds. On the second afternoon of their voyage into the Narrows, the Elysium Massif came over the horizon ahead of them, bulking alpenglow pink against a hyacinth sky. The coast of the mainland rose to the south as well, as if to stretch up and see the great massif across the bay. Bluffs alternated with marshes, and then a long tawny reach was succeeded by an ever higher sea cliff. The horizontal red strata of this cliff were all broken by bands of black and ivory, and the ledges were lined with mats of samphire and grasses, and streaked with white guano. The waves slammed into the sheer rock at the bottom of these cliffs and rebounded, the arcs of the backwash intersecting the oncoming swells in quick points of upshot water. In short, beautiful sailing, long glides down the swells, the wind an offshore powerhouse, especially in the afternoons, the spray, the salt tang in the air, for the North Sea was becoming salty, the wind in her hair, the white V tapestry of the ship's wake, luminous over the indigo sea. Beautiful days. It made Maya want to stay on board, to sail around the world and then around again, to never land and never change. There were people doing that now, she had heard. Giant greenhouse ships, utterly self-sufficient, sailing the great ocean in their own thassalocracy. But there ahead of them were the Narrows, narrowing. The trip from Dumarthuray was already almost over. Why were the good days always so short? Moment to moment, day by day, each so full and oh so lovely, and then gone forever. Gone before there was a chance to absorb them properly, to really live them. Sailing through life, looking back at the wake, high seas, flying wind. Now the sun was low, the light slanting across the sea cliffs, accenting all their wild irregularities, their overhangs, caves, sheer clean faces dropping directly into the sea, red rock into blue water, all untouched by human hands, though the sea itself was their work. Sudden shards of splendor splintering inside her. But the sun was disappearing, and the break in the sea cliffs ahead marked the first big harbor of the Narrows, Rhodos, where they would dock and the evening would come. They would eat in a harbor cafe next to the water in the long twilight, and that day's glorious sail would never come again. This strange nostalgia, for the moment just gone, for the evening yet to come. Ah, I'm alive again, she said to herself, and marveled that it could have happened. Michel and his tricks. One would think that by now she would have become impervious to all that psychiatric alchemical mumbo-jumbo. It was too much for the heart to bear, but, well, better this than the numbness, that was certain. And it had a certain painful splendor, this acute sensation. And she could endure it. She could even enjoy it somehow, in snatches, a sublime intensity to these late afternoon colors, everything suffused with them. And under such a flood of nostalgic light, the harbor of Rhodos looked gorgeous. The big lighthouse on the western cape, the pair of clanging buoys, red and green, port and starboard. Then into the calm, dark water of an anchorage, and down into rowboats in the failing light. Across black water through a crowd of exotic ships at anchor, no two the same, as ship design was going through a period of rapid innovation, new materials making almost anything possible, and all the old designs being reinvented, drastically altered, then returned to again. There a clipper ship, there a schooner, there something that looked to be entirely outrigger, finally to bang into a busy wooden dock in the dusk. Harbor towns at dusk were all alike. A Cornish, a curving narrow park, lines of trees, an arc of ramshackle hotels and restaurants backing the wharves. They checked into one of these hotels, and then strolled the dock, ate under an awning just as Maya had supposed they would. She relaxed in the grounded stability of her chair, watching liquid light oxbow over the viscous black water of the harbor, listening to Michelle talk to the people sitting at the next table, tasting the olive oil and bread, the cheeses and ouzo. It was strange how much beauty hurt sometimes, and even happiness. And yet she wished the lazy postprandial sprawl in their hard chairs would go on forever. Of course it didn't. They went up to bed hand in hand, and she held on to Michelle as hard as ever she could. And the next day they hauled their bags across town to the inner harbor just north of the first canal lock, and up into a big canal boat, long and luxurious, like a barge become cruise ship. They were two of about 100 passengers coming on board, and among the others was Vendana and some of her friends, and further on a private canal boat a few locks ahead, were Jackie and her consort of followers about to travel south as well. On some nights they would be docked in the same canal-side towns. "Interesting," Maya drawled, and at the word Michelle looked both pleased and worried. The Grand Canal's bed had been cut by an aerial lens, concentrating sunlight beamed down from a soleta. The lens had flown very high in the atmosphere, surfing on the thermal cloud of gases thrown up by the melted and vaporized rock. It had flown in straight lines and burned its way across the land without the slightest regard for details of topography. Maya vaguely remembered seeing vids of the process at the time, but the photos had necessarily been taken from a distance, and they hadn't prepared her at all for the sheer size of the canal. Their long, low canal boat, motored into the first lock, was lifted up a short distance on infilling water, motored out of an opening gate, and there they were, in a wind-rippled lake 2 kilometers wide, extending in a straight line directly southwest toward the Hellas Sea, 2,000 kilometers away. A great number of boats, large and small, were proceeding in both directions, keeping to the right with the slower ones closer to the banks, in the standard rules of the road. Almost all the craft were motorized, although many also sported lines of masts and schooner rig, and some of the smallest boats had big triangular sails and no engines. "Dhows," Michelle said, pointing. An Arab design, apparently. Somewhere up ahead was Jackie's campaign ship. Maya ignored that and concentrated on the canal, gazing from bank to bank. The absent rock hadn't been excavated but vaporized, and looking at the banks one could tell. Temperatures under the concentrated light of the aerial lens had reached 5,000 K, and the rock had simply dissociated into its constituent atoms and shot into the air. After cooling, some material had fallen back on the banks, and some back into the trench, pooling there as lava. So the canal had been left with a flat floor, and banks some 100 meters high, and each over a kilometer wide, rounded black slag levees on which very little could grow, so that they were nearly as bare and black now as when they had cooled 40 years before, with only the occasional sand-filled crack bursting with greenery. The canal water appeared black under the banks, shading to sky color out in the middle of the canal, or rather to a shade just darker than sky color, the effect of the dark bottom, no doubt, with streaks of green zigzagging across all. The obsidian rise of the two banks, the straight gash of dark water between. Boats of all sizes, but many of them long and narrow to maximize space in the locks. Then, every few hours, a canal-side town, hacked into the bank side and then spreading on top of the levee. Most of the towns had been named after one of the many canals on the classic Lowell and Antoniadi maps, and these names had been taken by the canal-besotted astronomers from the canals and rivers of classical antiquity. The first towns they passed were quite near the equator, and they were bracketed by groves of palm trees, then wooden docks backed by busy little waterside districts, pleasant terraced neighborhoods above, then the bulk of the towns up on the flats of the levees. Of course, the lens, in cutting a straight line, had carved a canal bed that rose directly up the great escarpment onto the high plain of Hesperia, a 4 kilometer rise in elevation. So every few kilometers, the canal was blocked by a locked dam. These, like dams everywhere these days, were transparent walls and looked as thin as cellophane, yet were still many magnitudes stronger than necessary to hold the water they held, or so people said. Maya found their window-pane clarity offensive, a bit of whimsical hubris that would surely be struck down one day when one of the thin walls would pop like a balloon and wreak havoc and people would go back to good old concrete and carbon filament. For now, however, the approach to a lock involved sailing toward a wall of water like the Red Sea parted for the passage of the Israelites, fish darting hither and thither overhead like primitive birds, a surreal sight, like something out of an Escher print. Then into a lock like a water-walled grave, surrounded by these bird fish, and then up and up and out onto a new level of the great straight-sided river, cutting through the black land. Bizarre, Maya said after the first lock, and the second, and the third, and Michel could only grin and nod. The fourth night of the trip, they docked at a small canal-side town called Narsaris. Across the canal was an even smaller town called Narmalka, Mesopotamian names, apparently. A terrace restaurant on top of the levee gave a view far up and down the canal and behind the canal to the arid highlands flanking it. Ahead, they could see where the canal cut through the wall of Gale Crater, floored with water. Gale was now a bulb in the canal, a holding area for ships and goods. After dinner, Maya stood on the terrace looking through the gap into Gale. Out of the inky talc of twilight, Vendana and some companions approached her. How do you like the canal? They asked. Very interesting, Maya said curtly. She didn't like being asked questions or being at the center of a group. It was too much like being an exhibit in a museum. They weren't going to get anything out of her. She stared at them. One of the young men among them gave up, began to talk to the woman next to him. He had an extraordinarily beautiful face, features neatly chiseled under a shock of black hair. A sweet smile, an unselfconscious laugh, altogether captivating. Young, but not so young as to seem unformed. He looked Indian, perhaps, such dark skin, such white regular teeth, strong, lean as a whippet, a good bit taller than Maya, but not one of these new giants, human scale still, unprepossessing, but solid, graceful, sexy. She moved toward him slowly as the group shifted into a more relaxed cocktail party format, people wandering around to talk and look down at the canal and the docks. Finally, she got a chance to speak with him, and he didn't react as if approached by Helen of Troy or Lucy the Habiline fossil. It would be lovely to kiss such a mouth. Out of the question, of course, and she didn't even really want to. But she liked to think about it, and the thought gave her ideas. Faces were so powerful. His name was Athos. He was from Lycus Vallis, to the west of Rhodos. Sansei, from a seafaring family, grandparents Greek and Indian. He had helped to found this new green party, convinced that helping Earth through its surge was the only way to stay out of the maelstrom. The controversial tail-wagging-the-dog approach, as he admitted with an easy, beautiful smile. Now he was running for representative from the Nepenthes Bay towns and helping to coordinate the green campaigns more generally. "We'll catch up with the Free Mars campaign in a few days?" Maya asked Vendana later. "Yes, we plan to debate them at a meeting in Gale." Then, as they were walking up the gangplank onto their boat, the young ones turned away from her, heading together up to the foredeck to continue partying. Maya was forgotten. She wasn't part of that. She stared after them, then joined Michelle in their little cabin near the stern, seething. She couldn't help it, even though she was shocked when it occurred. Sometimes she hated the young. "I hate them," she said to Michelle, and simply because they were young. She might disguise it as hatred of their thoughtlessness, stupidity, callowness, utter provincialism. That was all true. But beyond that, she also hated their youth. Not just their physical perfection, but simply their age, sheer chronology, the fact that they had it all in front of them. It was all best in anticipation. Everything. Sometimes she woke from floating dreams in which she had been looking down on Mars from the Ares after they had aerobraked and were stabilizing their orbit in preparation for the descent. And shocked at the abrupt fall back into the present, she realized that for her that had been the best moment of all, that rush of anticipation as it all lay there below them, anything possible. That was youth. Think of them as fellow travelers, Michelle advised now, as he had several times before when Maya had confessed to this feeling. They're only going to be young for as long as we were. A snap of the fingers, right? And then they're old, and then gone. We all go through it. Even a century's difference doesn't matter a damn. And of all the humans who ever existed and ever will exist, these people are the only ones alive at the same time we are. Just being alive at the same time, that makes us all contemporaries. And your contemporaries are the only ones who are ever going to really understand you. Yes, yes, Maya said. It was true. But I still hate them. The aerial lens's burn had been about equally deep everywhere, so when it had blazed across Gale Crater, it had cut a wide swath through the rim on the northeast and southwest sides. But these cuts were higher than the canal bed elsewhere, so that narrower cuts had been excavated through them and locks installed, and the inner crater made into a high lake, a bulb in the canal's endless thermometer. The Lowellian system of ancient nomenclature was in abeyance here for some reason, and the northeastern locks were bracketed by a little divided town called Birch's Trenches, while the southwestern lock's larger town was called Banks. The town Banks covered the melt zone of the burn and then rose in broad bending terraces onto the unmelted rim of Gale, overlooking the interior lake. It was a wild town, crews and passengers of passing ships pounding down their gangplanks to join a more or less continuous festival. On this night, the party was focused on the arrival of the Free Mars campaign. A big grassy plaza, perched on a wide bench over the lake lock, was jammed with people, some attending to the speeches given from a flat rooftop stage overlooking the plaza, others ignoring the commotion and shopping, or promenading, or drinking, or sitting over the lock eating food purchased from small smoky stands, or dancing, or wandering off to explore the upper reaches of the town. Throughout the campaign speeches, Maya stood on a terrace above the stage, which gave her a view of the backstage area where Jackie and the rest of the Free Mars leadership were milling about, talking or listening as they waited for their turn in the spotlight. Antar was there, Ariadne, some others Maya half-recognized from recent news vids. Observation from a distance could be so revealing. Down there she saw all the primate dominance dynamics that Frank used to go on about. Two or three of the men were fixed on Jackie, and in a different way a couple of the women. One of the men, named Mika, was on the Global Executive Council these days, a leader of the Mars First Party. Mars First was one of the oldest political parties on Mars, formed to contest terms of the renewal of the First Mars Treaty. Maya had been a part of that, she seemed to recall. Now Martian politics had fallen into a pattern somewhat resembling European parliamentary countries, with a broad spectrum of small parties bracketing a few centrist coalitions, in this case, Free Mars, the Reds, and the Dorsabrevian Matriarchy, with the others latching on or filling gaps or running off to the sides, all of them shifting this way and that in temporary alliances to advance their little causes. In this array, Mars First had become something like the political wing of the Red Ecoteurs still in the Outback, a nasty, expedient, unscrupulous organization folded into the Free Mars supermajority for no good ideological reason. There had to be some kind of deal going on, or something more personal, the way that Micah followed Jackie, the way he regarded her, a lover, or very recent ex-lover. Maya would have bet on it. Besides which, she had heard rumors to that effect. Their speeches were all about beautiful, wonderful Mars and how it was going to be ruined by overpopulation unless they closed it to further Terran immigration. There was a strong case to be made for that point of view, actually, as could be told by the cheers and applause from the crowd. Their attitude was deeply hypocritical, as most of those applauding made their living from Terran tourists, and all of them were immigrants or the children of immigrants, but they cheered anyway. It was a good election issue, especially if you ignored the risk of war, if you ignored the sheer immensity of Earth and its primacy in human civilization. Defying it in this way, well, it didn't matter. These people didn't give a damn about Earth, and they didn't understand it either. So defiance only made Jackie look more brave and beautiful, standing up for a free Mars. The ovation for her was loud and sustained. She had learned a lot since her maladroit speeches during the Second Revolution. She had gotten quite good. Very good. When the green speakers got up to take their turn and argue for an open Mars, they tried to talk about the danger of a closed Mars policy, but the response was, of course, much less enthusiastic than it had been for Jackie. Their position sounded like cowardice, to tell the truth, and the desirability of an open Mars, naive. Before arriving in Banks, Vendana had offered Maya a chance to speak, but she had declined, and now she was confirmed in her judgment. She didn't envy these speakers their unpopular stance before a dwindling crowd. Afterward, the Greens held a small party post-mortem, and Maya critiqued their performance with some severity. "I've never seen such incompetence. You're trying to scare them, but you only sound fearful. The stick is necessary, but you need a carrot as well. The possibility of war is the stick, but you have to tell them why it would be good to keep Terrans coming up without sounding like idiots. You have to remind them that we all have Terran origins. We are always immigrants here, for you can never leave Earth." They nodded at this, Athos among them looking thoughtful. After that, Maya got Vendana to one side and grilled her about Jackie's recent liaisons. Micca was indeed a recent partner, and probably still was. Mars First was, if anything, more anti-immigration than the larger party. Maya nodded. She had begun to see the outlines of a plan. When the post-mortem was over, Maya wandered downtown with Vendana and Athos and the rest until they passed a large band playing what they called Sheffield Sound. This music was only noise to Maya. 20 different drum rhythms at once, on instruments not intended for percussion or even for musical use, but it suited her purposes, as under the clatter and pounding she was able to guide the young Greens unobtrusively toward Antar, whom she had spotted across the dance floor. When they were nearer to him, she could say, "Oh, there's Antar. Hello, Antar. These are the people I'm sailing with. We're right behind you, apparently, headed to Hell's Gate and then Odessa. How's the campaign going?" And Antar was his usual gracious princely self, a man hard to object to, even when you knew how reactionary he was, how much he had been in the pocket of Earth, Arab nations. Now he must be turning on those old allies, another dangerous part of this anti-immigrant strategy. It was the curious way the Free Mars leadership had decided to defy the Terran powers and at the same time to try to dominate all the new settlements in the outer solar system. Hubris. Or perhaps they just felt threatened. Free Mars had always been the Young Natives Party, and if unrestricted immigration brought in millions of new Issei, then Free Mars's status would be endangered, not only its supermajority, but its simple majority as well. These new hordes, with all their old fanaticisms intact, churches and mosques, flags, hidden firearms, open feuds, there was definitely a case for the Free Mars position to be made. For during the intensive immigration of the past decade, the new arrivals had clearly begun to construct another Earth, just as stupid as the first one. John would have gone crazy. Frank would have laughed. Arcady would have said, "I told you so," and suggested yet another revolution. But Earth had to be dealt with more realistically than that. It couldn't be banished or wished away. And here in the moment, Antar was being gracious, extra gracious, as if he thought Maya might be useful for something. And as he always followed Jackie around, Maya wasn't surprised at all when suddenly Jackie and some others were at his side and everyone saying hello. Maya nodded to Jackie, who smiled back flawlessly. Maya gestured to her new companions, carefully introduced them one by one. When she came to Athos, she saw Jackie watching him, and Athos, as he was introduced, gave a friendly glance to her. Swiftly, but very casually, Maya started asking Antar about Zeke and Nazik, who were living on the coast of Acheron Bay, apparently. The two groups were moving slowly toward the music, and soon, if they kept going, they would be thoroughly mingled, and it would be too loud to hear any conversation but one's own.
"I like this Sheffield sound," Maya said to Antar. "Help me get through to the dance floor."
An obvious ploy, as she needed no help getting through crowds. But Antar took her arm and didn't notice Jackie talking to Athos, or pretended not to. It was an old story to him anyway. But that Mika, looking very tall and powerful up close, Scandinavian ancestry perhaps, looking a bit of a hothead. He was now trailing the group with a sour expression. Maya pursed her lips, satisfied that the gambit had started well. If Mars First was even more isolationist than Free Mars, then trouble between them might be all the more useful. So she danced with more enthusiasm than she had felt in years. Indeed, if you concentrated on the bass drums only, and held to their rhythms, then it was somewhat like the knocking of an excited heart. And over that fundamental ground bass, the chattering of the various woodblocks and kitchen implements and round stones was no more than the ephemera of stomach rumbling or rapid thought. It made a kind of sense, not musical sense as she understood it, but rhythmic sense in some way. Dance, sweat, watch Antar shuffle gracefully about. He must be a fool, but it didn't show. Jackie and Athos had disappeared, and so had Mika. Perhaps he would go Nova and murder them all. Maya grinned and spun in the dance. Michel came over, and Maya gave him a big smile, a sweaty hug. He liked sweaty hugs, and looked pleased but curious. "I thought you didn't like this kind of music."
"Sometimes I do."
Southwest of Gale, the canal rose through lock after lock up onto the highlands of Hesperia. As it crossed the highlands to the east of the Tirrenia Massif, it remained at about the 4 kilometer elevation, now more often called 5 kilometers above sea level, and so there was little need for locks. For days at a time they motored along the canal, or sailed under the power of the ship's line of little mast sails, stopping in some bankside towns, passing others. Oxus, Jaxartes, Scamander, Simois, Xanthus, Steropes, Polyphemus. They stopped in each, keeping a steady pace with the Free Mars campaign, and indeed with most of the other Hellas-bound barges and yachts. Everything stretched out without change to both horizons. Although occasionally in this region the lens had burned through something other than the usual basaltic regolith,
so that in the vaporizing and falling out there had occurred some variation in the levees, stretches of obsidian or sideromelane, swirls of brilliant glossy color, of marbled porphyry greens, violent sulfuric yellows, lumpy conglomerates, even one long section of clear glass banks, clear on both sides of the canal, distorting the highlands behind them and for long stretches reflecting the sky. This stretch, called glass banks, was of course intensively developed. Between the canal-side towns ran mosaic paths, shaded by palm trees in giant ceramic pots and backed by villas complete with grass lawns and hedges. The glass banks towns were whitewashed, bright with pastel shutters and window boxes and doors, and blue glazed tile roofs, and long colored neon signs over blue awnings in the waterfront restaurants. It was a kind of dream Mars, a canal cliché from the ancient dreamscape, but nonetheless beautiful for that, the obviousness of it indeed part of its pleasure. The days of their passage through this region were warm and windless, the canal surface as smooth as the banks and as clear, a glass world. Maya sat on the forward deck under a green awning, watching the freight barges and the tourist paddle-wheelers heading in the other direction, everyone out on deck to enjoy the sight of the glass banks and the colorful towns decorating them. This was the heart of the Martian tourist industry, the favorite destination for off-world visitors. Ridiculous, but true. And one had to admit it was pretty. Gazing at the passing scene, it occurred to Maya that whichever party won the next general election, and whichever way the immigration battle fell out, this world would probably go on, gleaming like a toy in the sun. Still, she hoped her gambit would work. As they barged farther south, the southern autumn put a chill in the air. Hardwood trees began to appear on the once-again basalt banks, their leaves flaring red and yellow, and one morning there was a skim of ice sheeting the smooth water against the shores. When they stood on the top of the western bank, the volcanoes Tarina Patera and Hadriaca Patera loomed on the horizon like flattened Fujis, Hadriaca displaying the banded maypole of white glaciers on black rock which Maya had first seen from the other side, coming up out of Dao Valles when she had made her tour of the flooding Hellas Basin so long ago. With that young girl, what was her name? A relative of someone she knew. The canal cut through the dragonback mounds of the Hesperia Dorsa. The canal-side towns grew less equatorial, more austere, more highland. Volga River towns, New England fishing villages, but with names like Astapus, Aeria, Eucronia, Apis, Eunostus, Agathodemon, Kaiko. On and on, the broad band of water led them, south by west, as straight as a compass bearing for day after day, until it was hard to remember that this was the only one, that such canals weren't webbed everywhere, as on the maps of the ancient dream. Oh, there was one other big canal at Boone's Neck, but it was short and very wide and getting wider every year as drag lines and the eastward current tore at it, no longer a canal, really, but rather an artificial strait. No, the dream of the canals had been enacted only here in all the world, and while here, cruising tranquilly over the water, one's view of everything else cut off by the high banks, there was a sense of romance in the air. A sense that their political and personal squabbles had a kind of Barsoomian grandeur. Or so it felt, strolling in the nip of an evening under the pastel neons of a canal-side town. In one, called Antaeus, Maya was strolling the canal-side promenade, looking down into boats large and small, onto beautiful big young people drinking and chatting lazily, sometimes cooking meat on braziers clamped to the railings and hung out over the water. On a wide dock extending into the canal, there was an open-air café from which came the plaintive singing of a gypsy violin. She turned into the café instinctively, and only at the last minute saw Jackie and Athos sitting at a canal-side table alone, leaning over until their foreheads almost touched, Maya certainly did not want to interrupt such a promising scene, but the very abruptness of her halt caught Jackie's eye so that she looked up, then started. Maya turned to leave, but saw Jackie was getting up to come over. Another scene, Maya thought, only partly unhappy at the prospect. But Jackie was smiling, and Athos was coming with her at her side, watching it all with wide-eyed innocence. Either he had no idea of their history, or else he had a good control of his expressions. Maya guessed the latter, simply because of the look in his eye, just that bit too innocent to be real. An actor.
"It's beautiful, this canal, don't you think?" Jackie was saying.
"A tourist trap," Maya said. "But a pretty one. And it keeps the tourists nicely bunched."
"Oh, come now," Jackie said, laughing. She took Athos's arm.
"Where's your sense of romance?"
"What sense of romance?"
Maya said, pleased at this public display of affection. The old Jackie wouldn't have done it. Indeed, it was a shock to see that she was no longer young. Stupid of Maya not to have thought of that, but her sense of time was such a mishmash that her own face in the mirror was a perpetual shock to her. Every morning she woke up in the wrong century, so seeing Jackie looking matronly with Athos on her arm was only more of the same, an impossibility. This was the fresh, dangerous girl of Zygote, the young goddess of Dorsa Brevia.
"Everyone has a sense of romance," Jackie said.
The years weren't making her any wiser. Another chronological discontinuity. Perhaps taking the longevity treatment so often had clogged her brain. Curious that after such assiduous use of the treatments there should be any signs of aging left at all. In the absence of cell division error, where exactly was it coming from? There were no wrinkles on Jackie's face. In some ways, she could be mistaken for 25, and the look of happy, boonian confidence was as entrenched as ever. The only way, really, she resembled John, glowing like the neon scrim of the cafe overhead. But despite all that, she looked her years somehow, in her eyes, or in some gestalt at work, despite all the medical manipulation. And then one of Jackie's many assistants was there among them, panting, gasping, pulling Jackie's arm away from Athos, crying,
"Jackie, I am so sorry, she's killed, she's killed!"
Shivering.
"Who?"
Jackie said sharply, like a slap. The young woman, but she was aging, said miserably,
"Zoe!"
"Zoe?
A flying accident, she fell into the sea."
This ought to slow her down, Maya thought.
"Of course,"
Jackie said. "But the bird suits," Athos protested. He was aging, too.
"Didn't they?"
"I don't know about that."
"It doesn't matter," Jackie said, shutting them up.
Later, Maya heard an eyewitness account of the accident, and the image stayed etched in her mind forever. The two flyers struggling in the waves like wet dragonflies, staying afloat so that they would have been okay until one of the North Sea's big swells picked them up and slammed them into the base of a sea stack, after which they had drifted in the foam. Now Jackie was withdrawn, remote, thinking things over. She and Zoe hadn't been close, Maya had heard. Some said they hated each other. But one's child. You weren't supposed to survive your children. That was something even childless Maya felt instinctively. But they had abrogated all the laws. Biology meant nothing to them anymore, and here they were. If Anne had lost Peter on the falling cable, if Nadia and Art ever lost Nicky. Even Jackie, as foolish as she was, had to feel it. And she did. She was thinking hard, trying to find the way out. But she wasn't going to. And then she would be a different person. Aging. It had nothing to do with time. Nothing.
"Oh, Jackie,"
Maya said, and put a hand forward. Jackie flinched, and Maya pulled the hand back.
"I'm sorry."
But just when people most need help is when their isolation is the most extreme. Maya had learned that on the night of Hiroko's disappearance, when she had tried to comfort Michelle. Nothing could be done. Maya almost cuffed the sniffling young aide, restrained herself. "Why don't you escort Ms. Boone back to your ship, and then keep people away for a while?" Jackie was still lost in her thoughts. Her flinch away from Maya had been instinct only. She was stunned, disbelieving, and the disbelief absorbed all her effort. All just as one would expect from any human being. Maybe it was even worse if you hadn't got along with the child. Worse than if you loved them. Ah, God. "Go," Maya said to the aide, and with a look commanded Athos to help. He would certainly make an impression on her, one way or the other. They led her off. She still had the most beautiful back in the world and held herself like a queen. That would change when the news sank in. Later, Maya found herself down at the southern edge of town where the lights left off and the starry sheen of the canal was banked by black berms of slag. It looked like the scroll of a life, someone's world line. Bright neon squiggles moving across a landscape to the black horizon. Stars overhead and underfoot, a black piste over which they glided soundlessly. She walked back to the boat, stumped down the gangplank. It was distressing to feel this way for an enemy, to lose an enemy to this kind of disaster. "Who am I going to hate now?" she cried to Michel. "Well," Michel said, shocked. Then, in a comforting tone, "I'm sure you'll think of someone." Maya laughed shortly, and Michel cracked a brief smile. Then he shrugged, looking grave. He, less than any of them, had been lulled by the treatment. Immortal stories in mortal flesh, he had always insisted. He was downright morbid about it. And here another illustration of his point. "So the all-too-human got hers at last," he said. "She was an idiot with all those risks. She was asking for it. She didn't believe in it." Maya nodded. No doubt true. Few believed in death anymore, especially the young who never had, even before the days of the treatment, and now less than ever. But believe in it or not, it was touching down more and more, mostly, of course, among the super-elderly. New diseases or old diseases returned, or else a rapid, holistic collapse with no apparent cause. This last had killed Helmut Bronski and Derek Hastings in recent years, people Maya had met, if not known well. Now an accident had struck someone so much younger than they were that it made no sense. Fit no pattern but youthful recklessness, an accident, random chance. "Do you still want to get Peter to come?" Michel asked, from out of a whole different realm of thought. What was this? Realpolitik from Michel? Ah, he was trying to distract her. She almost laughed again. "Let's still get in touch with him," she said. "See if he might come." But this was only to reassure Michel. Her heart wasn't in it. That was the beginning of the string of death.
This ends side one of cassette 17. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.